following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Rock, rock, rockin' the cold. Yeah. Rock, rock, rockin' the cold. Rock, rock, rockin' the cold. Oh, once she grabs, she won't let go. Rock, rock, rockin' the cold. Rock, rock, rockin' the cold.
None of that soft stuff.
Rock, rock, rockin' the cold.
None of that heavy metal stuff.
Rock, rock, rockin' the cold.
Just a little bit of jazz.
Rock, rock, rockin' the cold.
What do you think?
Just I like love that. It. That was great. Thank you.
A theme song to get us started today. On the show, welcome to it. I am Nicole Sandler. We talk about things that happen in the world. And today was the seventh in a series of hearings put on by the House Select Committee investigating the events surrounding January 6th, 2021, the attack on the Capitol. And it seems like with each hearing, it gets more and more jaw-dropping. Today, actually, I want to start with something that just happened at the very end. So, you know, maybe you didn't see it, maybe you did see it, but they got through a few hours of pretty damning testimony. And we'll play some clips. By the way, the phone lines are open. Should you care to weigh in on any of it, 954-889-6410 is the phone number. If you're on Skype, you can Skype in. I'm Nicole Sandler, all one word, all lowercase, easy to find. So we'll go through it. By the way, I need to apologize because yesterday I told you it was going to be 10 a.m. Eastern. Because that was the original time they gave, and I had it in my notes, but they moved it. I also said that there is going to be a second hearing this week on Thursday night in prime time. That was also scheduled, but they pulled back and said, no, they're moving that to next week. Because they got a whole lot more information, including this that we learned about at the very, very end. So, Liz Cheney, what was that you wanted to tell us? What happened to one of the witnesses?
And one more item. After our last hearing, President Trump tried to call a witness in our investigation.
Uh-oh.
A witness you have not yet seen in these hearings.
Uh-oh.
That person declined to answer or respond to President Trump's call and instead alerted their lawyer to the call. Their lawyer alerted us, and this committee has supplied that information to the Department of Justice. Let me say one more time, we will take any effort to influence witness testimony very seriously. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
As they should, as they should. Okay, so again, today was the seventh in the series of hearings, and the two people who were testifying today were, as all the other witnesses have been, Republicans or Republican sympathizers or acolytes of the president, people who were supporters. Some of them still are. Some of them, like the two witnesses today, not so much, it seems. But anyway, I said the phone lines are open. And the way it works is I have no screener, no producer. So if you call, you know, listen, make sure that I've hung up on the previous caller and then call in when I answer your phone. We're on the air. So if I do pick up, don't listen through the computer or the streaming radio or whatever. Listen through the phone because otherwise you won't hear me. All right. Hi, caller from the 347 area code. Who's this?
Hi, this is Jonathan. I'd like to weigh in on the January 6th hearings.
Oh, hi, John. Okay, so, yeah, what'd you think of the hearings today?
I think it showed the true nature of who we knew this man Donald Trump is. He's a selfish, narcissistic, disrespectful, evil man.
Yeah.
And he's out evil. And I don't understand why. Yes, what he did was wrong, but what I heard a lot of things like that was not how it was supposed to be. That's really ridiculous.
Okay.
And it's sad.
It is sad. So do you think Donald Trump should be prosecuted?
Yes, I think his whole family should be. And we should stop. Here's what the establishment Democrats. Yes, I have to prosecute Donald Trump. Stop fear-mongering. Because what you're doing is, young voters like me who want to vote for you, I don't see any policy. My advice to you, after you prosecute him, don't stop fear-mongering about him. And that's not, like, yeah, he's a bad person.
Who's fear-mongering? Who's fear-mongering? And what do you mean? What are they doing?
No, I'm talking about the establishment. Every time they use fear-mongering tactics, like the establishment Democrats use.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, we're not talking about that today, Jonathan. We'll do that another day. Thank you for calling. I'm glad to know you're listening. I'm glad you are watching the hearings. I think it's really important. I'll tell you what's very sad is the people with their heads in the sand, the Trumpers, the MAGAT crowd, who just, you know, instead of listening to actual news, to real coverage, to in real time, these hearings, to find out what happened, they have their heads not only in the sand, but up Donald Trump's ass. So there's a guy I follow. His name is Aaron Rupar. He used to write for Vox, and he'd cover, you know, all the crap they would do on the Fox Not News channel. And he left Vox, and started his own Substack. So he's doing the same work, just working for himself and a subscription service. And he posts videos, and, you know, he keeps a running thread on it. So he's one of a number of people that I follow. Well, the maggots swarmed his Twitter feed today. So it was really hard to keep up with what was going on following his feed because the maggots infiltrated it. I really don't understand these people. I get it that they're disillusioned with life. I get it that life gave them a shitty hand. Hello. I'm part of that group too. But what I don't get is their refusal to listen to the evidence and understand what happened. Every expert, everybody, and people from within Trump's inner circle, from Bill Barr on down, said, there's no there. You did not win this election. There was not enough fraud that can be proven anywhere that would have swung even one state. And he lost in more than one state. It was time to give up. Everybody, to the last person on his staff, told him that. But then he had these little cretins in Congress going, no, fight, do it. You know, you have the Paul Gosars and the Marjorie Q. Greens and those kind of people who are egging him on. And then people like Lindsey Graham, who are so afraid that they'll be othered, jump on. Because, you know, Lindsey Graham, the night of January 6th, said, that's it. I'm done. It's over. I've had enough. I can't do this anymore. I'm done. And then 2 days later, he was sucking the mushroom dick again. So, you know, I almost feel sorry for those people. I would feel sorry for them if the future of this nation wasn't riding on it. But I, you know, if you look at Aaron Rupar's Twitter feed, it's at @ATRUPAR. And you'll see all the trolls in there going, yeah, well, what else? What about, name one cop who died that day. The only person who was killed was an unarmed woman, Ashley Babbitt. Yes, unarmed, but they had broken the glass and she was trying to break into the chamber of Congress. She was trying to break through the outer door leading into the House of Representatives. If anything deserves, you know, someone said there's a gun, they have a gun, you get the hell out of there. Actually, you don't try to go through the broken glass window in the first place. She was rightfully killed. She should never have been there. And the people around her were armed, so fuck you. The whole thing is just so infuriating. And these people say, so tell me the name of any cops. Well, you know what? Officer Fanone. Right, is it Fanone? You know, Brian Fanone, who died? Yes, they said it was a stroke. It was it was spurred by the events of that day. Yeah, he finally died the next day. But if you think he wasn't killed by those insurrectionists, then you don't understand how these things work. The officers that committed suicide, gee, I wonder why that happened. Maybe they thought everything they worked for was a sham. I don't know. I can't get inside these people's heads. But if you think that those deaths were not a direct result of the action taken by those insurrectionists on January 6th, then you need to go back to school. You need to open a fucking newspaper and read and turn off Fox News and Newsmax nonsense and all those other bullshit sites where they make shit up. Stop believing the bullshit. So I played for you Liz Cheney's closing statement from today's testimony. Now let me share with you how she started, because boy, they just hit the ground running. Take it away, Lizzie.
The strategy is to blame people his advisors called, quote, the crazies for what Donald Trump did. This, of course, is nonsense. President Trump is a 76-year-old man.
Yep.
He is not an impressionable child.
Well,
just like everyone else in our country, he is responsible for his own actions and his own choices. As our investigation has shown, Donald Trump had access to more detailed and specific information showing that the election was not actually stolen than almost any other American. And he was told this over and over again. No rational or sane man in his position could disregard that information and reach the opposite conclusion. And Donald Trump cannot escape responsibility by being willfully blind.
He'll try, though. He'll try again and again and again. All right, so here's what we're going to do. I'm going to play clips. I'm going to try to do them in the order in which they happened. Again, feel free to jump in at any time. I don't have a guest schedule today. I did put out a couple of invites, and I should check every once in a while to make sure that none of my invited guests have shown up. I don't believe any have. I doubt that's going to happen. Anyway, so but if you want to call in, please do. I will either hear or see that you're on the line. And again, remember to listen. Oh, I've got the wrong thing up here. Listen, and then listen through the phone and not the radio if you do it. Okay, so we're going to move on. So today's hearing was led basically by two of the members of the committee, Jamie Raskin, who I love, and Stephanie Murphy, who I don't, but she was very good today. And apparently she's been on this case for a long, long time. I mean, she's got reasons to not trust Trump and his ilk, mostly because she is an immigrant. All right, let's listen to Stephanie Murphy. And funny, she's going to talk about somebody else in the administration, a former Trump administration official named Eugene Scalia. Yes, the same family. This, I believe, was Justice Scalia's son, but don't quote me on that. But they are related.
Gene Scalia, an accomplished lawyer and the son of late Justice Scalia,
the son,
called President Trump in mid-December and advised him to concede and accept the rulings of the courts.
Whoa.
And so I had to put a call into the president. I might have called on the 13th. We spoke, I believe, on the 14th, in which I conveyed to him that I thought that it was time for him to acknowledge that President Biden had prevailed in the election. But I communicated to the president that when that legal process is exhausted and when the electors have voted, that that's the point at which that outcome needs to be expected. I told him that I did believe, yes, that once those legal processes were run, if fraud had not been established, that had affected the outcome of the election, then unfortunately, I believe that what had to be done was concede the outcome.
You think? What had to be done was concede the outcome. That was Antonin Scalia, you know, the former Supreme Court justice, the one whose seat they held open for a year so that Barack Obama, the sitting president at the time, couldn't name his successor, as is the rule. Yeah, says he needed to call and concede, something that Donald Trump has never done. Now, remember, we talked about Cipollone or Cipollone. I'm not quite sure how we pronounce it, but Cipollone or Cipollone was the White House counsel. In other words, he was the John Dean to Donald Trump. John Dean, of course, was White House counsel to Richard Nixon, who spilled the beans in the Watergate hearings. Now, Cipollone was not quite as forthcoming. You'll hear he holds back a couple of times, but it sounded like he really wanted to testify, and he did.
As Attorney General Bill Barr testified, December 14th should have been the end of the matter.
December 14th was the day that the state certified their votes and sent them to Congress.
That's Barr, Bill Barr.
In my view, that was the end of the matter. I didn't see, I thought that this would lead inexorably to a new administration.
Mr. Cipollone also testified that the president's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, said he shared this view.
As early as that November 23rd meeting, we understand that there was discussion about the president possibly conceding the election. And specifically, we understand that Mark Meadows assured both you and Attorney General Barr that the president would eventually agree to a graceful exit. Do you remember Mr. Meadows making any such representation?
Are you saying as part of that meeting or separately? Again, without getting into that meeting, I would say that is a statement and a sentiment that I heard from Mark Meadows.
I see. And again, do you know if it was on November 23rd or some point?
Again, I it was probably, around that time, and it was probably subsequent to that time. It wasn't a one-time statement.
Yeah, so he didn't know the exact date, as I wouldn't either, but there you go. So that's the testimony that was just recorded on Friday. Remember, Cipollone sat for, depending on who your source is, 7 to 8.5 hours, somewhere in there, and was pretty forthcoming from what they say. All right, so let's keep going. And next up is... what was this one? Oh, more Cipollone. Because there's a lot of Cipollone stuff here.
Told us that he agreed with the testimony that there was no evidence of fraud sufficient to overturn the election.
I want to start by asking if you agree, Mr. Cipollone, with the conclusions of Matt Morgan, of Bill Barr, of all of the individuals who evaluate those claims, that there is no evidence of election fraud sufficient to undermine the outcome in any particular state.
Yes, I agree with that.
No
evidence.
And
Mr. Cipollone also specifically testified that he believed that Donald Trump should have conceded the election.
Uh-oh.
Did you believe, Mr. Cipollone, that the president should concede?
Yes.
Once you made a determination based on the investigations that you credited DOJ did, that the campaign did you in your mind form a belief that the president should concede the election loss at a certain point after the election?
Well, again, I was the White House counsel. Some of those decisions are political. So to the extent that, but if your question is, did I believe he should concede the election at a point in time? Yes, I did. I believe,
yes, he did.
Leader McConnell went onto the floor of the Senate, I believe, in mid-December.
Yes, he did.
And basically said, the process is done.
Yes, he did. And then they all backtracked.
My thinking on these things.
That would be in line with my thinking on these things, he said. But then McConnell and Lindsey and the rest of them all backtracked. Go figure. I don't get it. But interesting, the next clip has two blonde women. Who both knew it was over, too. Although, gee, they didn't say that publicly.
Mr. Meadows has refused to testify, and the committee is in litigation with him. But many other White House officials shared the view that once the litigation ended and the Electoral College met, the election was over. And here's President Trump's former press secretary.
Uh-oh.
I wanted to clarify, Ms. McEnany, so back to my previous question, it was your view then, or was it your view, that the efforts to overturn the election should have stopped once the litigation was complete?
In my view, upon the conclusion of litigation was when I began to plan for life after the administration.
Oh, life after the administration.
And this is what Ivanka Trump told us.
Oh, Ivanka. Vanky.
December 14th was the day on which the Electoral College met, when these electors around the country met and cast the electoral votes consistent with the popular vote in each state. And it was obviously a public proceeding or a series of proceedings that President Biden had obtained the requisite number of electors. Was that an important day for you? Did that affect sort of your planning or your realization as to whether or not there was going to be an end of this administration?
I think so. I think it was my sentiment probable prior as well.
Probable prior? What? Well, she doesn't speak English. There's something about that woman. I can't quite put my finger on it. Maybe you know. Anyway, Ivanka. Jared was there too. You can't do one of these without having a Jared weighing in.
This testimony from Attorney General Barr reflecting a view of the White House staff in late November 2020.
And then at that point, I left. And as I walked out of the Oval Office, Jared was there with
Jared.
Dan Scavino, who ran the president's social media, and who I thought was a reasonable guy and believe is a reasonable guy. And I said, how long is he going to carry on with this stolen election stuff? Where is this going to go? And by that time, Meadows had caught up with me and leaving the office and caught up to me and said he said, look, I think that he's becoming more realistic and knows that there's a limit to how far he can take this. And then Jared said, you know, yeah, we're working on this. We're working on
it. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Jared said they're working on it. They're working on it. Ugh. Yeah. Oh, at least we didn't get to hear Jared that time. I can only take so much of the smarm, you know? All right. So moving right along, again, the hosting duties, the questioning responsibilities were split today by Stephanie Murphy of Florida. She's retiring, by the way. She's not running for another term. And Jamie Raskin, who I'd like to see get one of those $400 haircuts because he really needs somebody to calm it down and style it and get it to a place that it can be okay. And then he can take care of it from there. So he needs to do something about his hair, but then he should run for president. Anyway, we're not talking about that today, though. All right. So Jamie Raskin then comes back in with a bit more of the questioning.
We've learned that President Trump's White House counsel agreed with the Department of Justice about this.
Attorney General Barr made a public announcement on December 1st, less than a month after the election, that he had seen no suspended fraud, sufficient evidence. Fair to say that by December 1st, you had reached the same conclusion.
It's fair to say that I agree with Attorney General Barr.
Uh-huh.
Cipollone
again.
Conclusion on December 1st. Yes, I did, and I supported that conclusion.
As of December 1st, that was Cipollone, the White House counsel, and he said he knew by December 1st that there was no there. There was no fraud that stole the election, that was nonsense. Nonsense. And then Bill Barr continues to talk about, yet we both knew. So you heard from Bill Barr, you heard from Cipollone. And yet Barr says Trump persisted. I'm going back and forth between two machines here. So,
as you'll see in this clip, the president asked Attorney General Bill Barr to have the Department of Justice seize voting machines in the states.
My recollection is the president said something like, we could get to the bottom. You know, some people say we could get to the bottom of this if the department seized the machines. It was a typical way of raising a point. And I said, absolutely not. There's no probable cause, and we're not going to seize any machines.
And that was that.
Not going to seize any machines.
But this wasn't the end of the matter. On the evening of December 18th, 2020, Sidney Powell, General Michael Flynn, and others entered the White House for an unplanned meeting with the president.
Oh, this was wild.
The meeting that would last multiple hours and become hot-blooded and contentious. The executive order behind me on the screen was drafted on December the 16th, just 2 days after the Electoral College vote, by several of the president's outside advisors over a luncheon at the Trump International Hotel.
Whoa.
As you can see here, this proposed order directs the Secretary of Defense to seize voting machines, quote, effective immediately. But it goes even further than that. Under the order, President Trump would appoint a special counsel the power to seize machines and then charge people with crimes with all resources necessary to carry out her duties.
Her duties.
The specific plan was to name Sidney Powell as special counsel. The Trump lawyer who had spent the post-election period making outlandish claims about Venezuelan and Chinese interference in the election, among others.
So Trump drafts this executive order calling on the attorney general to seize all the voting machines and names Sidney Powell a special counsel to oversee it all? Okay, we need to keep this going because this is some crazy shit.
Denouncing Sidney Powell's terrible idea.
There was a real question in my mind and a real concern, you know, particularly after the attorney general had reached the conclusion that there wasn't sufficient election fraud to change the outcome of the election, when other people kept suggesting that there was, the answer is, what is it? And at some point, you have to put up or shut up.
You think?
That was my view.
Why was this, on a broader scale, a bad idea for the country?
To have the federal government seize voting machines, it's a terrible idea.
You think?
That's not how we do things in the United States. There's no legal authority to do that. And there is a way to contest elections, you know, that happens all the time. But the idea that the federal government could come in and seize election machines, now that's I don't understand why we even have to tell you why that's a bad idea.
Yeah.
It's a terrible idea.
It is.
For all of its absurdity, the December 18th meeting was critically important because President Trump got to watch up close for several hours as his White House counsel and other White House lawyers destroyed the baseless factual claims and ridiculous legal arguments being offered by Sidney Powell, Mike Flynn, and others. President Trump now knew all these claims were nonsense. Not just from his able White House lawyers, but also from his own Department of Justice officials, and indeed his own campaign officials. As White House counsel Pat Cipollone told us,
with respect to the whole election fraud issue, it, to me, it's sort of, if you're going to make those kind of claims, and people were open to them early on because people were making all sorts of claims, and the real question is, show the evidence.
Yeah.
Okay.
Evidence. Evidence. That's something that they never did. They never had any evidence. But I'm going to let Jamie Raskin keep going because here I believe they're going to talk a little bit more about Sidney Powell and the absurdity of all that.
Chief of Staff Mark Meadows told people that he thought Trump should concede around the time the Electoral College certified the result. But nonetheless, he later worked to try to facilitate President Trump's wishes. Here's what Cassidy Hutchinson told us.
During this period, I perceived his goal with all of this to keep Trump in office. You know, he had very seriously and deeply considered the allegations of voter fraud. But when he began acknowledging that maybe there wasn't enough voter fraud to overturn the election, you know, I witnessed him start to explore potential constitutional loopholes more extensively, which I then connected with John Eastman's theories.
Okay.
The startling conclusion is this. Even an agreed-upon complete lack of evidence could not stop President Trump, Mark Meadows, and their allies from trying to overturn the results of a free and fair election. So let's return to...
So, I mean, what Jamie Raskin just said there, they knew without a doubt, they heard it from so many different authorities, there was no fraud. And if you managed to uncover one or two instances, which, by the way, they did, and all of the perpetrators were Trump voters who voted for in the villages in Florida, they, as far as I know, they did not come up with one instance of a Democrat trying to vote twice. Republicans, yeah, there were a handful or two of them. Republicans trying to steal the votes, not us. And they were told it over and over and over again. But despite all that, they just didn't care. Or I should say, Trump didn't care. Trump just wanted to steal the election. So, okay, earlier they touched on, I forget who was testifying, touched on that meeting, that secret meeting in the Oval Office on December 18th. It was late at night. Mark Meadows had already left. Most of the staff had left. And this went on for hours. And it got contentious. And there was yelling and screaming from the Oval Office. This is the juicy part. I can't wait to see this part in the movie.
That it was going to work, that you were going to be able to get to see the president without an appointment?
I had no idea.
In fact, you did get to see the president without an appointment.
This is Sidney Powell.
We did.
How much time did you have alone with the president? And I say alone, you had other people with you, but
right
from his aides before the crowd came running?
Probably no more than 10 or 15 minutes.
Was in that...
I bet Pat Cipollone set a new land speed record.
I got a call either from Molly or Cushman that I need to get to the Oval Office.
That's Cipollone again.
That was the first point that I had recognized.
And this is Cassidy.
Okay, there was nobody in there from the White House. Mark's gone. What's going on right now?
I opened the door and I walked in. I saw General Flynn. I saw Sidney Powell sitting there. I was not happy to see the people in the Oval Office.
Explain why.
Explain why.
I don't think they were providing. Well, first of all, the overstock person, I never knew who this guy was.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to pause this here because the chairman of overstock.com was among the people in this meeting. Here's the White House counsel, Cipollone, Pat Cipollone, saying, I don't know who this guy is. What was he doing in the White, in the Oval Office late at night in a meeting that wasn't cleared? This went against all protocols because there are protocols for someone to be allowed into not only the White House, but certainly into the Oval Office. And they went around all of that. And it was late at night. So Cipollone walks in there, sees all these people, this overstock guy, Michael Flynn, all these other people, and goes, I'm sure, says, what the fuck? I mean, that part wasn't testimony, but I'm sure that's what he was thinking. All right, let's get back to the testimony.
And I walked in, I looked at him, and I said, who are you?
Who
and
are
he
you?
Told me. I don't think any of these people were providing the president with good advice.
No.
And so I didn't understand how they had gotten in.
In the short period of time that you had with the president, did he seem receptive to the presentation that you were making?
He was very interested in hearing particularly about the FISA finding
about
and
the finding?
Terms of 13848 that apparently nobody else had bothered to inform him of.
Because it's nonsense, you Creon.
I was asking, like, you claim the Democrats were working with Hugo Chavez, Venezuelans, and whomever else. And at
this
one
is
point,
Eric Kirchman.
General Flynn took out a diagram that supposedly showed IP addresses all over the world and ISP, who was communicating with whom via the machines, and some comment about like Nest thermostats being hooked up to the internet.
So yeah, that's what the Sidney Powell was talking about. So this other guy, Hirschman, was talking about. It's bananas. It's nuts. banana nut bread. But Michael Flynn was there, and now they refer back to Michael Flynn's testimony where he pled the fifth.
So it's been reported that during this meeting, Ms. Powell talked about Dominion voting machines and made various election fraud claims that involved.
Chief of Staff Mark Meadows.
Hold
told
on.
People,
oh, I hit the wrong
so
button.
It's been reported that during this meeting, Ms. Powell talked about Dominion voting machines and made various election fraud claims that involved foreign countries such as Venezuela, Iran, and China. Is that accurate?
The fifth.
Was the meeting tense?
The fifth, he said.
Oh, yeah. It was not.
This is Derek Lyons, former White House staff secretary.
Explain.
I mean, at times there were people shouting at each other, hurling insults at each other. It wasn't just sort of people sitting around on a couch, like, chit-chatting.
Do you recall whether he raised to Ms. Powell the fact that she and the campaign had lost all of the 60 cases that they had brought in litigation?
Yes, he raised that.
And what was the response?
I don't remember what she said. I don't think it was a good response.
Cipollone and Hirschman and whoever the other guy was showed nothing but contempt and disdain of the president.
Well, I wonder why.
The three of them were really sort of forcefully attacking me verbally. Eric, Derek, and we were pushing back and we were asking one simple question. As a general matter, where is the evidence?
Evidence! Where's the evidence?
What response did you get when you asked Ms. Powell and her colleagues, where's the evidence?
A variety of responses based on my current recollection, including, you know, can't believe you would say something, like, you know, things like this, like, what do you mean, where's the evidence? You should know, you know, and things like that.
You should know?
You know. A disregard, I would say, a general disregard for the importance of actually backing up. Say
with facts.
And you know, then there was
okay, so basically they're talking about in that meeting, that late night meeting in the Oval Office, when Cipollone came in and saw that what was going on with these crazies there giving Trump horrible advice, and then he starts challenging, where's the evidence? And there is no evidence. And that's what was going on. So later on, I don't know if I have these clips or not, but you hear they were yelling at one another. There were people who were afraid it was going to come to punches. So let's just keep going. All right, Jamie Raskin, please continue, sir. Talking with this other guy, Eric Hirschman, who was also
staff
there.
Mark Meadows told people that he thought Trump should concede around the time the Electoral College certified the result. But nonetheless, he later worked to try to facilitate President Trump's wishes. Here's what Cassidy Hutchinson told us.
During this period, I perceived his goal with all of this to keep Trump in office.
Mark Meadows, she's talking about. That was his goal.
You know, he had very seriously and deeply considered the allegations of voter fraud. But when he began acknowledging that maybe there wasn't enough voter fraud to overturn the election, you know, I witnessed him start to explore potential constitutional loopholes more extensively, which I then connected with John Eastman's theories.
All right, so she's talking about Mark Meadows there.
The startling conclusion is this. Even an agreed-upon complete lack of evidence could not stop President Trump, Mark Meadows, and their allies from trying to overturn the results of a free and fair election. So let's return to...
Okay, so there's so much more. Obviously, I'm only bringing you clips that I can play in the course of this hour. This hearing went on for probably 3 hours. But I hope I'm giving you a good running narrative of what happened. Of course... I'm wondering why Rudy Giuliani has not been brought before that that committee yet, and why he's still walking around, why this man isn't in jail. Although we do have him here in a deposition, and of course, Rudy, eloquent as always.
I categorically describe it as
you guys are not tough enough. Or maybe I put it another way, you're a bunch of pussies. Excuse the expression.
Oh, but fuck you.
I'm almost certain the word was used.
Flint's.
He's almost certain the word was used. Yeah, probably regarding you. This might be out of order, because I think this goes back to that meeting. More with Sidney Powell.
Days, no further steps were taken to appoint Sidney Powell, but there is some ambiguity about what the president actually said and did during the meeting. Here is how Pat Cipollone described it.
I don't know what her understanding of whether she had been appointed, what she had been appointed to. Okay. In my view, she hadn't been appointed to anything and ultimately wasn't appointed to anything because there had to be other steps taken. So that was my view when I left the meeting, but she may have a different view and others may have a different view and the president may have a different view.
Were any steps taken, including the president himself telling her she'd been appointed?
Again, I'm not going to get into what the president said in the meeting. My recollection is you're not appointed until steps are taken to get the paperwork done. And when I left the meeting, I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm not going to get into what the president said.
Oh, of course not.
Or say you wanted.
Mr. Cipollone, when the matter continued to flare up over the next several days, was it your understanding that Sidney Powell was still seeking an appointment or that she was asserting that she had been appointed by the president at the December 18 meeting?
You know, now that you mentioned it, probably both.
Huh.
You know, in terms of like, I think she may have been of the view that she had been appointed and was seeking to, you know, get that done. And that she should be appointed.
Oh, my goodness. It's like her being appointed as special counsel is like, the guy that from the Justice Department underling who Trump wanted to make acting attorney general. And they all threatened to quit if that happened. So the more you know, the more you know. Okay, so we're going to move ahead a little bit. They did take a break in here somewhere, and you'll see a little slight change in the subject matter. But now we get to the point where Trump puts out the tweet. And this tweet proved to be very, very consequential. Here we go.
Supporters responded immediately. Women for America First, a pro-Trump organizing group, had previously applied for a rally permit for January 22nd and 23rd in Washington, D.C., several days after Joe Biden was to be inaugurated. But in the hours after the tweet, they moved their permit to January 6th, 2 weeks before. This rescheduling created the rally where Trump would eventually speak. The next day, Ali Alexander, leader of the Stop the Steal organization and a key mobilizer of Trump supporters, registered wildprotest.com, named after Trump's tweet. Wildprotest.com provided comprehensive information about numerous newly organized protest events in Washington. It included event times, places, speakers, and details on transportation to Washington, D.C. Meanwhile, other key Trump supporters, including far-right media personalities, began promoting the wild protest on January 6th.
January 6th.
It's Saturday, December 19th.
This is Alex
the
Jones.
The year is 2020.
It's Alex Jones.
And one of the most historic events in American history has just taken place. President Trump, in the early morning hours today, tweeted that he wants the American people to march on Washington,
yeah,
D.C.
he did.
On January 6th, 2021.
And now Donald Trump is calling on his supporters to descend on Washington, D.C., January 6th.
He is now calling on we, the people, to take action and to show our numbers.
We're going to only be saved by millions of Americans moving to Washington, occupying the entire area, if necessary, storming right into the Capitol. We know the
this
rules
was December 31st.
If you have enough people, you can push down any kind of a fence or a wall.
this could be Trump's last stand.
Wow.
And it's a time when he has specifically called on his supporters to arrive in D.C.
Yeah. And the thing is, that was the tweet. It says, it'll be wild. He sent that tweet out after that December 18th meeting. I believe it was that night, like late at night, in the middle of the night, after that contentious meeting that almost came to fisticuffs inside the Oval Office. Oh, but it gets better. It just keeps getting better. All right, here. Go, Jamie Raskin.
Here's the former employee whose voice has been obscured to protect their identity discussing Trump's stand back and standby comment.
Twitter employee. Former Twitter employee.
My concern was that the former president, for seemingly the first time, was speaking directly to extremist organizations and giving them directives. We had not seen that sort of direct communication.
Direct
before.
Communication. The president talking to these cretins.
That concerned me.
So just to clarify further, you were worried, and others at Twitter were worried, that the president might use your platform to speak directly to folks who might be incited to violence?
You think? Yes, he said yes.
I believe that Twitter relished in the knowledge that they were also the favorite and most used service of the former president, and enjoyed having that sort of power.
So that is a former Twitter employee whose voice was disguised, saying that this was when they realized he was using their platform to communicate with these insurrectionists, with the Proud Boys, with the Oath Keepers. So, and this is where we get into the second part of the second part of the hearing today, when they get to the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys.
Another central figure with ties to this network of extremist groups was Roger Stone, a political consultant and longtime confidant of President Trump. He pardoned both Flynn and Stone in the weeks between the election on November 3rd and January 6th. In the same time frame, Stone communicated with both the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers regularly. The committee obtained encrypted content from a group chat called Friends of Stone, FOS, which included Stone, Rhodes, Tario, and Ali Alexander. The chat focused on various pro-Trump events in November and December of 2020, as well as January 6th.
Okay.
As you can see here, Stuart Rhodes himself urged the Friends of Stone to have people go to their state capitals if they cannot make it to Washington for the first Million MAGA march on November 14th. These friends of...
Okay, I'm breaking in here 1 second to point out something in case you missed it. On the top of the screen there, it says FOS, Friends of Stone, encrypted chat. The committee got access to the encrypted chat messages. And this one and the next one, you're going to see a lot of the inner communications of the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys because they got the encrypted messages. Wow.
Roger Stone had a significant presence at multiple pro-Trump events after the election, including in Washington on December the 12th. On that day, Stuart Rhodes called for Donald Trump to invoke martial law, promising bloodshed if he did not.
You hear this? Listen to this.
He needs to know from you that you are with him, that he does not do it now while he is commander-in-chief. We're going to have to do it ourselves later in a much more desperate, much more bloody war. Let's get it on now while he is still the commander-in-chief. Hoo-ah!
Hoo-ah! Really?
That night, the Proud Boys engaged in violence on the streets of Washington and hurled aggressive insults at the police.
You oath breakers! Do your fucking job! Give us 1 hour! 1 hour.
Wow. So that, okay, you see where we're going now? But strap in, because it gets thornier. Oops. Hold on. I went the wrong way. Let me back this up to the beginning. I hit the wrong button. Here we go.
Just the previous night, the co-host of InfoWars issued an ominous warning at a rally alongside Roger Stone and Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio. Encrypted chats obtained by the select committee show that Kelly Meggs, the indicted leader of the Florida Oath Keeper, spoke directly with Roger Stone about security on January 5th and 6th. In fact, on January 6th, Stone was guarded by two Oath Keepers who have since been criminally indicted for seditious conspiracy.
Good.
One of them later pleaded guilty, and according to the Department of Justice, admitted that the Oath Keepers were ready to use, quote, lethal force if necessary against anyone who tried to remove President Trump from the White House, including the National Guard.
Whoa. What? Including the National Guard. Lovely. You see what's being planned here? So now, we're going to bring you the next clip, has to do with the next meeting of, as somebody referred to it, the GOP coup caucus on December 21st was the next meeting of this group of insurrectionists.
You may also recall testimony given in our earlier hearing by Acting Attorney General Richard Donahue, who said that the president asked the Department of Justice to, quote, just say that the election was corrupt.
Oh, yeah.
Leave the rest to me and the Republican congressman. According to White House visitor logs obtained by the committee, members of Congress present at the White House on December 21st included Congressman Brian Babin, Andy Biggs,
oh,
Matt Gaetz,
ah,
Louis Gohmert.
She's naming names.
Paul Gosar.
Andy Harris.
Jody Heiss. Jim Jordan.
Scott Perry.
Then Congresswoman-elect Marjorie Taylor Greene was also there.
Marjorie Taylor Greene.
We heard testimony in an early hearing that a pardon was ultimately requested by Congressman Mo Brooks and other members of Congress who attended this meeting. We've asked witnesses what happened during the December 21st meeting. And we've learned that part of the discussion centered on the role of the vice president during the counting of the electoral votes. These members of Congress were discussing what would later be known as the Eastman theory, which was being pushed by attorney John Eastman. In one of our earlier hearings, you heard in great detail that President Trump was trying to convince Vice President Pence to do something illegal.
Yeah, you think? Oh, but wait, there's more. Let's keep going, because it gets better.
The next day, on January 5th, the day before the attack on the Capitol, tens of thousands of people converged on Washington. While certain close associates of President Trump privately expressed concerns about what would occur on January 6th, other members of the president's inner circle spoke with great anticipation about the events to come. The committee has learned from the White House phone logs that the president spoke to Steve Bannon, his close advisor, at least twice on January 5th.
Oh, at least twice.
The first conversation they had lasted for 11 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Listen to what Mr. Bannon said that day after the first call he had with the president.
Yeah.
All hell is going to break loose tomorrow.
Ugh.
It's all converging, and now we're on, as they say, the point of attack.
Wow.
Right? The point of attack tomorrow. I'll tell you this. It's not going to happen like you think it's going to happen.
Uh-oh.
Okay, it's going to be quite extraordinarily different.
Quite
and all
extraordinary.
I can say is strap in.
Really? So that's what Steve Bannon said on his radio show the day after, or the day that he spoke to Trump about what was going to happen the next day on January 6th. He had two conversations with Trump that day, and he goes on the air and says that. Well, then this happened.
The open door of the Oval Office, the president could hear the sound of the crowd and the music at the rally at the Freedom Plaza. And these are some of the things that they were saying there at the plaza, just blocks from where the president sat that evening, excited for the next day.
This is nothing less than an epic struggle for the future of this country between
Stone.
Dark and light.
Yeah, you're the dark, you
between
fucking moron.
Between the godly and the godless. Between good and evil. And we will win this fight or America would step off into 1,000 years of darkness.
Tomorrow, trust me, the American people that are standing on the soil that we Michael are standing Flynn. On tonight, and they're going to be standing on this soil tomorrow, this is soil that we have fought over,
oh,
fought
please.
For, and we will fight for in the future. The members of Congress, the members of the House of Representatives, the...
As a young woman from Florida.
You know what?
Murphy.
I'm sorry. I hit the wrong one again. Wait a minute. I'm not. Hold on. I'm going back and forth between two machines and I hit the wrong one. I wanted you to finish hearing that one. So let me bring that clip back up because
office,
that was too important.
The president could hear the sound of the crowd and the music.
Hold on. Let me cue in a little bit. All right. We'll go back to
Congress,
that one.
The
sorry.
Members of the House of Representatives, the members of the United States Senate. Those of you who are feeling weak tonight, those of you that don't have the moral fiber in your body, get some tonight because tomorrow we the people are going to be here and we want you to know that we will not stand for a lie. We will not stand for a lie.
I want them to know
they will not stand for a lie. Oh, this is Ali Alexander.
76 is always an option.
Yeah! Really? Ali Alexander.
These degenerates in the deep state are going to give us what we want, or we are going to shut this country down.
Nice. Gee, is that a threat?
1776.
Alex Jones.
1776. 1776. 1776.
Okay, that, yeah. What, yeah. So that... all happened. That was on January 5th, riling people up for the next day. Well, the next clip I'm going to show you, and I'm a warning to the Progressive Voices channel, we may run over a few minutes today because I want to get through this. So if you want to keep coming, going with us, you can come on over to NicoleSandler.com/listen-live because I have the YouTube video embedded on that page, so you can just pick up and you can see the video as well. Or come back to NicoleSandler.com and get the podcast later or get the YouTube video later. What I just want to let you know, we're going to get cut off in about, 3 minutes or so. But I'm going to keep going to get all this information out, okay? Because, as Chris Anderson said in the chat room, wow, I feel sick. And you should. All right, so the next, they had sworn in now the two witnesses for the day. First one is a guy named Stephen Ayers. And Stephen Ayers, he was charged in with, I don't know what he was charged for, but he was one of the January 6th rioters, insurrectionists, who now has a change of heart. So we'll pick up right there.
And from Florida, Ms. Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, earlier today, we showed how Donald Trump's December 19th tweet summoned both extremist groups as well as rank and file supporters of President Trump to come to Washington, D.C., average Americans. He told them to, quote, be there, we'll be wild, and they came. We showed how President Trump repeatedly told them, fight, 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 and they marched to the Capitol. Mr. Ayers, you were in that crowd at the rally and then the crowd that marched to the Capitol. When you arrived on the Ellipse that morning, were you planning on going to the Capitol?
No, we didn't actually plan to go down there. We went basically to see the Stop the Steal rally and that was it.
So why'd you decide to march to the Capitol?
The president, got everybody riled up. Told everybody head on down. So we basically were just following what he said.
Basically, we were just following what he said. You get that? He said, and he elaborated a bit more. Basically, we did what the president told us. If he had told us to leave and go down there earlier, we would have done that. Okay. The other witness today was a guy named Jason Van Tack. Kovol or something. I don't know his name right. But he is the former spokesman for the Oath Keepers. Now, I believe he had already left the Oath Keepers before these events happened, but he still knows how they work.
Mr. Van Tatenhoff, in the run-up to January 6th,
there you go.
Stuart Rhodes publicly implored President Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act, the 1807 law that allows the president to call up militias to put down a rebellion against the United States. And I want to get your thoughts about this in the context of your prior relationship with Stuart Rhodes. I understand that you had conversations with Rhodes about the Insurrection Act. Why was he so fixated on that? And what did he think it would enable the Oath Keepers to do?
Well, I think it gave him a sense of legitimacy, that it was a path forward to move forward with his goals and agendas. I think we need to quit mincing words and just talk about truths. And what it was going to be was an armed revolution. I mean, people died that day. Law enforcement officers died this day. There was a gallows set up in front of the Capitol. This could have been the spark that started a new civil war, and no one would have won there. That would have been good for no one. He was always looking for ways to legitimize what he was doing, whether by wrapping it in the trappings of it's not a militia, it's a community preparedness team. We're not a militia, we're an educational outreach group. It's a veteran support group.
Oh, please.
But again, we've got to stop with this dishonesty and the mincing of words and just call things for what they are. You know, he's a militia leader. He had these grand visions of being a paramilitary leader. And the Insurrection Act would have given him a path forward with that. You know, the fact that the president was communicating, whether directly or indirectly, messaging, you know, kind of that gave him the nod. And all I can do is thank the gods that things did not go any worse.
Yeah. So he's feeling a little remorse after the fact. People need to stop mincing words. All right. I have another clip. This is out of order, but it's going to have bearing on something else I'm about to show you. So this is where things got all crazy and I was rushing at the end. I would have been more organized at this point had the hearing started at 10 a.m. instead of 1 p.m., but, you know, you get what you get, and you don't get upset. All right, I'm just going to go without any commentary. Here's another clip.
Last month, on June 28th, Sergeant Gunnell's team of doctors told him that permanent injuries he has suffered to his left shoulder and right foot now make it impossible for him to continue as a police officer.
This is one of the Capitol police officers who was injured, seriously injured, on January 6th.
He must leave policing for good and figure out the rest of his life. Sergeant Gunnell, we wish you and your family all the best. We are here for you. We salute you for your valor, your eloquence, and your beautiful commitment to America. I wonder what former President Trump would say to someone like Sergeant Gunnell, who must now go about remaking his life. I wonder if he could even understand what motivates a patriot like Sergeant Gunnell. In his inaugural address, Trump introduced one commanding image, American carnage.
Oh, yeah.
Although
yes,
that turn of phrase explained little about our country before he took office, it turned out to be an excellent prophecy of what his rage would come to visit on our people.
American carnage. Who can forget? Who can forget American carnage? I think that now is a good time. We're going to get back to that in a moment. But now is a really good time to go into Jamie Raskin's. Do I have it up here? Is this? No, hold on. This one. Ah! Where is it? Okay, it's right here. To Jamie Raskin's closing, because he made some really important points.
Chairman, these hearings have been significant for us and for millions of Americans. And our hearing next week will be a profound moment of reckoning for America. But the crucial thing is the next step. What this committee, what all of us will do to fortify our democracy against coups, political violence, and campaigns to steal elections away from the people. Unlike Mr. Ayers and Mr. Van Tatenhove, people who have recovered and evolved from their descent into the hell of fanaticism, Donald Trump has only expanded his big lie to cover January 6th itself. He asserts the insurrection was the real election, and the election was the real insurrection. He says his mob greeted our police officers on January 6th with hugs and kisses. He threatens to take one of America's two major political parties with him down the road to authoritarianism, and it is Abraham Lincoln's party, no less. The political scientists tell us that authoritarian parties have two essential features in common in history and around the world. They do not accept the results of democratic elections when they lose, and they embrace political violence as legitimate. And the problem of incitement to political violence has only grown more serious in the internet age, as we have just heard. But this is not the problem of one party. It is the problem of the whole country now. American democracy, Mr. Chairman, is a precious inheritance, something rare in the history of the world and even on Earth today. Constitutional democracy is the silver frame, as Lincoln put it, upon which the golden apple of freedom rests. We need to defend both our democracy and our freedom with everything we have and declare that this American carnage ends here and now. In a world of resurgent authoritarianism and racism and anti-Semitism, let's all hang tough for American democracy. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I yield back.
Yes, please, let's all hang tough for American democracy. Something's got to be done here. And I'm not sure what the answer is. So I'm looking for this tweet thread that I read about, because people in the chat room were talking about how after the hearing ended, there is video, or there are still photos anyway, of Ayers, Stephen Ayers, the insurrectionist, going up to those police officers and apologizing. But hold on, I got to find Brandy Buckman, who these days writes for Daily Kos, has also been doing a really, really good job of covering this. And I know I saw she had the story here. So bear with me while I try to find this, because, okay. So here she shows a picture, and I'll show you the picture anyway, if I can. I can't even bring it up there. Okay, basically, of Stephen Ayers hugging Harry Dunn, the big black cop who's made the media rounds. And he said, "I'm really sorry." It says Ayers told Harry Dunn, hugging him, "I'm really sorry." But that doesn't tell the whole story, because apparently, let me see if I can't find Brandy's, okay. Here's a couple others. Let me just read to you, because there's, if you follow her on Twitter, she's got a bunch of good stuff. Here she writes, former Oath Keeper says of January 6th, "We must stop mincing words." Well, I played that clip. You saw that, so I don't need to repeat it again. I want to find the part about, and now I can't find it. Basically what happened is this guy Ayers went by all the cops that were seated there and hugged them and apologized. But there was a widow there whose husband committed suicide the next day. Remember, I think there were at least two of them. I think maybe three. And why can't I find, no, I can't find her thing. He skipped over the widow of the officer who committed suicide and didn't say anything to that person and went to the next cop there to apologize. It's just, you know, another example of how messed up these people are. It's like the idiots on Twitter, the trolls who are coming to me saying, "Tell me the name of one other person other than Ashley Babbitt who died that day." Well, the cops, even the cops who committed suicide, the one who allegedly had a stroke, you don't think that was spurred by this, exacerbated by this? And so, you know, I don't often watch Fox, but Jonathan Turley, who used to be on the air with Keith Olbermann all the time, was on Fox. And listen to what he had to say about today's testimony.
There were some reports that Scipione was not specifically asked about contradictions that he had with other witnesses, but he was trying to keep that careful line. Now, it's still damaging. The account of that meeting in the office is really breathtaking. It's very disturbing. At one point, there was a suggestion that there might be fisticuffs. It was almost like Dr. Strangelove and the president saying there's no fighting in the war room. It was just a bizarre moment of you're in the Oval Office and people seem to be actually chest pounding. So this is very disturbing. All of these details should disturb everyone. But the question is what.
Yeah. So anyway, that's what Jonathan Turley said. And needless to say, the reaction on many of the other actual news channels is even more, I don't know what the word is, disgusted, shocked, terrified, you name it. So yeah, there's more. But obviously, that's my hour and 10 minute long recap of what happened today, as much as I could share with you. They'll have coverage all over the place tonight. Rachel Maddow and MSNBC will go over it as well. They'll probably do a much better job than I did because they've got a staff of producers and writers and a lot of people doing the work where I just do it all myself. And so, therefore, it comes across as if I do it all myself. But, you know, I try. Anyway, yeah, there's no fighting in the war room. That's the best line from one of the best movies of all time. All right. Well, tomorrow, we'll probably wind up talking about this a little bit with our guests. We've got a really fascinating guest tomorrow. His name is David Pepper. He was on this show a few years ago when he had a book out. He had a brand new book. And now, hold on, I've got to see if I can find tomorrow's the 13th. Yes. I forget the name of the book he wrote. But he published a thread on Twitter Monday. That was so important. It's long, but I'll read to you the beginning of it. He said, thread, let's do some real originalism, shall we? You know, because the Supreme Court, they're talking about how they were originalists and it doesn't say the word abortion in the Constitution. He said, let's do some real originalism, shall we? The Guarantee Clause, Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution, may be the most important clause in the Constitution no one pays attention to. But at this fraught time for our democracy, we must, Congress must, read on. And he goes on to talk about the Guarantee Clause. And what it says. So we're going to get into that tomorrow, as well as, you know, everything else. So I don't know about you. I can't wait till next week's hearing. And I hope that that's not the last one because, or I hope that they tie it up in a neat little bow and they present it to Attorney General Merrick Garland and say, do something. I'm ready to see the indictments now. And it should include the big orange El Gordo and his offspring, his evil spawn. Because one thing we've learned from these hearings is they're all complicit. They're all complicit. They tried to overthrow the government of the United States of America. There, I came out and said it. Trying to undo the results of a legitimate election? No, they tried to overthrow the government and seize control. And we need to not let that happen. And the rest of the country needs to get with the program too and understand that's what happened. It's shocking. You go on, you know, troll Twitter and you see they're all still carrying his water. So my message to them is stop it. Just stop it. All right. I'm going to go. I will see you mañana, and we'll continue the conversation there. And yes, you do want to hear David Pepper tomorrow. You can thank me later. All right. I'll leave you with the news, and thank you for listening, as always. Have a good night. Try to sleep. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
They're back. The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack is holding its next public hearing today, Tuesday, July 12th. They'll examine the ways in which the former guy and his leading supporters sought help from far-right extremists to pressure lawmakers into overturning his loss to Joe Biden in the 2020 election. Despite the false information I imparted yesterday, the testimony gets underway today at 1 p.m. Eastern. And the second hearing this week that I mentioned was scheduled for Thursday has now been moved to next week. So sorry, or never mind. Moving right along, committee members previewing the hearing over the weekend said that the panel today will be connecting the dots between the far-right militia groups like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys and those in government who are trying to overturn the election. QAnon's involvement and Donald Trump's incendiary tweet that day that read, quote, "Big protest in D.C. on January 6th. Be there. We'll be wild." Will all be probed. Roger Stone and Michael Flynn's involvements will come to the surface today. Expected to testify is a man named Jason Van Tattenhove. He is a former spokesperson for the Oath Keepers. Today's hearing will be led by committee members, Representatives Jamie Raskin of Maryland and Stephanie Murphy of Florida. We'll have full coverage today on the Nicole Sandler Show from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern.
We just did.
Available after that as a podcast anytime from NicoleSandler.com. Moving on to abortion rights. The Department of Health and Human Services said Monday that the Biden administration will require healthcare providers to offer abortion services if necessary to save the life of a mother. The guidance said that the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act defines emergency medical conditions under which those involved in the procedure would be protected, even in states where abortion is banned. Those conditions include ectopic pregnancy, complications of pregnancy loss, or emergent hypertensive disorders such as preeclampsia with severe features. On Sunday, Biden said he was considering declaring an abortion-related public health emergency in the wake of the extreme court decision overturning Roe. We'll see. The president also held an outdoor gathering at the White House on Monday where he addressed our gun violence epidemic. He said mass shootings have turned once safe places in the country into killing fields. These remarks were part of a, quote, celebration. Yeah, they were celebrating the passage of the first major piece of gun safety legislation by Congress in 30 years. Biden called the law, quote, an important start, but said the nation must, quote, galvanize this movement because that's our duty to the people of the nation. But the president's remarks were interrupted by Manuel Oliver. He's the father of one of the victims of the mass shooting in 2018 at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. Before he was escorted from the grounds, Oliver said, "You have to do more." And I'll just say, yes, they do. And sadly, two people were killed and three wounded in four shootings that occurred before dawn on Monday at four different 7-Eleven stores in Southern California. Authorities said they were seeking a lone gunman in at least three of the shootings. One police spokesman said, there's no way this can be a coincidence of it being 7-Eleven, July 11th. Oh, man. Oh, one more 1-6 related story. A federal judge on Monday refused to delay the criminal contempt trial of Steve Bannon. You remember him, that one-time strategist and longtime ally of the former guy. Bannon faces trial next week for defying a subpoena to testify to the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Bannon, who helped push Trump's bogus claim that the election was stolen from him, had said he'd challenge the subpoena. But his lawyer sent the committee a letter over the weekend notifying that Bannon was willing to cooperate in a bid to delay the trial. It didn't work. If convicted, Bannon could face up to 2 years in jail along with fines. That's all. Oh, and you'll like this one. A judge in Fulton County, Georgia, ordered Senator Lindsey Graham to testify next month before a special grand jury investigating those same efforts by the former guy and his allies to reverse Trump's narrow election loss in the state to President Biden. Graham, one of eight people subpoenaed last week, had vowed to fight the subpoena, but the judge ruled that the senator, quote, is a necessary and material witness in the investigation into potential criminal interference in the state's 2020 presidential election. The order said the grand jury needs Graham to describe his two phone calls to Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, whom Trump had asked to reverse the election result. And finally, President Biden on Monday revealed the first full-color photo from the James Webb Space Telescope. He said, quote, "These images are going to remind the world that America can do big things." NASA added that the image showed was a slice of the vast universe, roughly the size of a grain of sand, held at arm's length by a person on the ground. Quote, "You're seeing galaxies that are shining around other galaxies whose light has been bent, and you're seeing just a small, little portion of the universe." And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.